the meeting to order. Let the record reflect that the State Senate In-State Energy Committee was convened at 7:30 a.m. February 14th, 2013. Happy Valentine's Day, everybody. The following Senate members are present today. Senators Co-Chair Coghill, Senator Machicki, Senator Egan, and Senator Wilikowski, and myself, Senator Bishop. I'd like to recognize the staff today, Christopher Dickrell, Senate Records Lori Berg, our LIO moderator. My committee staff is Pete Fellman, and before we get started, let's just do a cell phone check. And today we have Gwen Holman with us, and Gwen, please come on up to the table, please, ma'am. And Gwen is the director of the Alaska Center for Energy and Power at UAF, and we've requested Gwen to come here to this committee and present an overview of the work she's doing at the university. Gwen, the floor is yours. And do you prefer questions as we go along, or would you like us to hold them to the end? Or
no, please ask them as they come up as we go along.
We're a pretty talkative group with lots of questions, you know, and I'd like to keep that free flow exchange going if that's all right with you.
I appreciate that as well.
Okay. The deck set and it's all yours.
Okay. Thank you very much. I very much appreciate the opportunity to come and speak before this committee. I think that you've been working on some very serious issues for the state, and I'd like to talk a little bit about what we've been working on at the university. Some of it is very relevant to some of the issues that's before you here today, part of this body, and some of it's thinking a little bit further out. You know, what are our opportunities, not just today, but maybe 10, 20, 30, 50 years from now? This is a slide, just something that we added up a few years ago, just looking at, if we do nothing, what are we on track to do? And, you know, this is just fuel costs in the rail belt, $60 billion in the villages, $5 billion. This is if we do nothing about our, that's just essentially status quo, replacing existing generation. I had an interesting conversation with Representative Edgman, who had totaled up that since 2008, we've spent about $2.3 billion in energy-related appropriations between the Power Cost Equalization Program, between the Renewable Energy Fund, between some of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation programs, and then some of the initiatives that we've started with the pipeline and looking at Susitna as well.
Quick question, ma'am, if you don't mind, Gwen. Should I call you
Absolutely.
Gwen or Ms. Holdman? We will definitely spend $5 billion on diesel and $60 billion on fossil fuels at some point.
Right.
What's the time?
I'm sorry. Excellent point. That was over a 20-year horizon.
Okay,
yes.
Thank you.
Sorry about that. So, our energy challenges, all of you are well familiar with these, having been longtime Alaskans, high energy costs, that's an issue for many parts of the state. Fragmented electric grid. This is something that I think it's worth talking about this just a little bit. It's intuitive. We understand that we have communities all over the state, including the rail belt, that are disconnected to other electric grids. We're not connected to Canada. We're not connected to the lower 48. And that poses a little bit of a different set of challenges for us compared to anywhere in the lower 48, where you can generate power over here, wheel it over there. We have some really unique challenges, and that's not just in the rural communities, but that's an issue for the rail belt as well. And I think we need to keep that in mind. Harsh climate, that's a reality of operating in Alaska. We're aware of that. This image that I have here is of one of our researchers that's working on looking at frazzle ice development in super-cooled water in rivers. So before we have freeze-up, we get these situations where you're very super-cooled water, below freezing. And so ice forms very quickly. It nucleates. It sticks to anything that's in the river. And what winds up happening is it can really wreak havoc with infrastructure. I was out in the community of Igiagic, and there was a telecommunications cable that had been laid across the river there. This had happened. It had frozen on the cable. A foot of ice had formed on this cable, floated it, and actually moved the cable downstream. And that's something that, for the telecommunications company that had put that in, that had never occurred to them that something like that could happen. But that's the reality of working in Alaska. There's some, you know, certainly different circumstances up here. But at the end of supply lines, we have a lot of fantastic resources, whether they're fossil or renewable, but a lot of those are stranded. That's a reality, and it's a dispersed population. So I work for the Alaska Center for Energy and Power. I come from private sector. I've been a project developer. I've built projects in the past, and I believe that there's a real role for the university in working with industry, working with communities, and working with you and trying to figure out how we can move forward. And there's really three main ways that I think that the university can play a role in, on these issues. One is developing information. And I look at that as a very simple and broad kind of overarching umbrella term, but whether that is an individual homeowner that's trying to figure out what to do for his home, or whether that's you here at the legislature or a community leader, we are producing information that decision makers can use to make good decisions. That's really fundamentally one of the things that we are trying to do at the Alaska Center for Energy and Power. That could include testing technologies so that we have information for industry about what technologies might be the most appropriate for the Alaskan environment. And it could include energy analysis. We've done a lot of analysis work that's supported some of the work that you're doing moving forward and shows us a little bit what you know, the different options are. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. Preparing students to work in energy-related disciplines, this is a big deal for us. We want to make sure that our young people here in Alaska have opportunities not just to get a good education, but also to really work closely with industry in the state because we want them to be taking those energy jobs that are we believe are going to be there in the future. And we have students that have gone from the Alaska Center for Energy and Power to work in industry. We have students at BP and Shell right now. We have students at WH Pacific. We have students working in the renewables industry with Ocean Renewable Power Company, for example. One of our interns is working there today. And so that's really what we're trying to do. We're also attracting some of our students back to Alaska. Some of the students that have gone outside, some of our best students for an education, we're now bringing back to get a graduate degree through the Alaska Center for Energy and Power. And we have several of those that are working with us now. They've been outside, they want to come back, they want to work on Alaska energy issues, and we want to provide them with an opportunity to do that in the state. And then commercializing energy innovation. This is someplace where we work very closely with industry. There are times where there are real barriers for industry to move forward, and it's an industry-wide challenge. It's not a company challenge. And when that takes place, there's a real opportunity for the university to come in and say, hey, we have this big problem here, and I'll give the example of the hydrokinetics industry. We're not going to have a successful hydrokinetics in-river and tidal energy industry without dealing with the issue of debris. It's just not going to happen. That's a problem for every single manufacturer that has any interest in operating in the state. And so what we've done is we've developed a debris diversion system and tested it in the NANA last summer that actually was very successful. We did not have any problems with debris hangup. And so it's just an example of where we are working with private sector. They're very excited about what we've developed, and that's the kind of thing that isn't just going to work in Alaska, but could work other places in the world, too.
Gwen, will you get into that debris diversion?
Diversion device? I don't have a great deal of information on that here. What I can tell you, Senator, is we do have these. We're doing real stuff. We're not just sitting in an office and completing studies. And on the NANA test site, I know that one thing that for the industry, we have videos online that show the testing that we did where we brought full, like, you know, 40-foot-long logs and root wads and put that in front of our device to test. We tried to break it. Mm-hmm. And it's worked really well. And it's something that we're patenting because it has a unique design to it. We're doing something a little different. It's not just something that's diverting debris, but it's actually actively working to remove debris. So when some of our industry partners came and actually saw what we were doing, came to NANA, their level of enthusiasm is very high right now in terms of the work that we're doing. And it's not a huge amount of money. You know, we're doing this on a pretty minimal budget. You have the capital improvement project request that we have, and that would be to support exactly those kinds of efforts. And a portion of that is to continue this work that we're doing with the hydrokinetic industry. We've been working on surface debris, but there's a lot of neutrally buoyant debris, too. And we need to characterize that and see what we can do about that as well.
So. Senator Machicki?
Go ahead. I'm sorry. You were still. No. Oh. One of my goals, and we've talked about this as well, is at least a baseline. We don't have a statewide energy plan. We have pieces of a statewide energy plan, but what's missing is a good baseline. And I know there are agencies that have picked up some of the pieces, but does the university have the capacity, if a study were funded, divides our state up into logical segments and the sources that are available in those segments? I mean, is that something that ACEP has the capacity for?
Yeah, and one of the things that the short answer is yes. The long answer is that we've been doing exactly that kind of work. We've been working Alaska Energy Authority is one of our closest partners. We also work pretty closely with DGGS on looking at some of our, you know, other options. We've been looking at geothermal with them, looking at coal resources, things like that. We have been very involved in that in the past and would like to continue to be involved in that kind of work. With that being said, the way we operate, the last, and I should have maybe explained this a little earlier, but actually this is a good slide to talk about that. We are building teams of researchers at the university. When I came to the university, I realized there's a wealth of existing knowledge and expertise there. We don't need to hire a bunch of new people. We need to take advantage of the people that are already there that have capability to work in these energy-related areas. And some of them don't even think of themselves as energy researchers. When we look at the hydrokinetics program, we have fish biologists working on our team. They've never thought of themselves as being involved in the energy industry in Alaska, but they have expertise that we need. Same thing with geologists. We work closely with wherever there's a researcher that has skills that we can pull into our teams, we do that. They stay where they are. They can work on other projects. They don't just work on ours, but we build teams across disciplines, across schools, across institutes, and across campuses. We work with UAA. One of our closest partners is ICER, Institute for Social and Economic Research. We do a lot of work with them. But we also work with the School of Engineering. We work with them on cold climate effects on wind turbine blades, for example. So there's a lot of ways that we pull together teams, work on an issue, and then move on and do something else. And we also work really closely with industry on this. And so that's the kind of thing that we're doing, is figuring out what the research questions are, putting together a team and addressing that, and then making sure that we're not competing with industry. Where there's an opportunity to bring private sector in to do, say, a bathymetric study for our hydrokinetics work, or some kind of a geophysical study out in Nome to support our geothermal work, we bring them in. They do that. There's not a research question associated. We focus on where is there a research question and how can university address that. So,
Thank you.
I can't just let that go. I'm glad he teed that up and brought that question up. Just a quick follow-up on that. I concur with Senator Machikian concept on what he just said, and we could get into a whole hour and a half discussion on what that would look like, but I just got to share this. You know, I'm a fan of T. Boone Pickens. He says we're going to go down as the dumbest nation on the earth if we don't get an energy plan in the United States. Jack Welch this morning, right?
Yeah.
The single number one thing this country could do, get an energy plan. So, Alaska, energy plan.
But, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if those exact same words were echoed in these halls 30 years ago.
They were. I read them 50 years ago.
Yeah. And it's something that's been worked on a lot, and this committee's worked on it, and the Senate Resources Committee. Senator Wielkowski, you and I have worked together a little bit on these issues, and I applaud those efforts, but we need to keep on moving forward. So, yeah, I agree. This is just an example of how we're building teams at the university. And I apologize, I realize belatedly there's a few acronyms in here, but one of the things that we've done is geothermal energy. This is an area that has some potential for the state. There's interest in it here, in the Cook Inlet area, and then there's also some resources scattered throughout the state. One of the things that we've done, and this is just illustrative of this team concept, is that we've brought together researchers at the Geophysical Institute that pioneered a mapping technique for volcanoes. To look for where there's heat sources, basically looking at potential impending eruptions. And they also used it for mapping underground coal fires. But they're basically looking at mapping low-quality heat and then figuring out what that really means, quantifying it. And we used this technique and applied it to low-temperature geothermal evaluation. We got a grant from the Department of Energy to test this technique because it can really reduce the cost of exploration, and that's one of the challenges with geothermal. It's very expensive in the exploration phase. So we went ahead and did that. We got a significant grant to test and develop this technique. We did that in Alaska. It could have been done anywhere in the country. But we picked Alaska. We picked, in this case, Pogum Hot Springs outside of Nome because we think it's one of the better resources that has potential to be developed on mainland Alaska. It's been very successful. We identified where the hot water is coming from, which has been a long-standing mystery out there, and are, you know, now moving forward with the next phases of exploration with the community, with the landowners. It's on Native Corporation land, and looking at what the potential is there. In the meantime, there's a significant graphite resource that's been discovered just 10 miles away. And so one of the things we really want to do is not just look at things in isolation. It's about a bigger holistic plan. How can we look at where our energy resources are in concert with some of our mineral resources and our communities? How can we pull this together? And to add on to that, we have a lot of DOD facilities, and they're very interested in understanding where their energy supply is going to be coming from long term. How do we pull it all together? How can we take a more holistic approach to something like that? And I think that's where the university has a role to play. There's a lot of people that are working on it. And to go on further, UAV, unmanned aerial vehicles, we're now going to be continuing this by using an unmanned vehicle platform to, again, expand this. And the footprint, by using this technique, we were able to expand the footprint of this particular resource from very small, just, you know, here's the hot springs, right, in the size of this room, to almost, you know, a 4 mile across area that we've identified small amounts of heat that you couldn't tell from the ground that there was any heat there. So it's a pretty substantial resource. It's about an order of magnitude larger than the Chena Hot Springs resource, and we think it has potential for that region, for example. Now we want to apply that same technique to weatherization, looking at where we should target improved weatherization by identifying, you know, you can map an entire city and take a look at where your biggest problems are across the city, and you can actually quantify that by using thermal data and then converting that to numbers in terms of energy efficiency and heat loss. Yeah.
Gwen, FLIR?
Forward-looking infrared radiometry. It's basically infrared imaging. That's not the technique we've developed. That's been used worldwide. We're not using, the cameras are not any different. It's the processing technique. We're able to create algorithms that remove any kind of background signal, like slope, vegetation, things like that, that would interfere with you getting a quantifiable number, not just a quality number. You're, okay, there's heat, it's hot. What does that mean? You know, so that's what we've been doing. The way we're funded, ASAP has some base funding from the state of Alaska, about $750,000 a year. We have 18 million and 20 active projects right now across a whole gamut of different technology areas. These are grants and contracts that I don't believe would have come into the university or the state. These are, because of our team building concept, these are things that we've been able to do that I don't think anyone else in the state would have been able to do. And I think it's really important to understand that we as a research enterprise are really a funding source for the University of Alaska. By bringing in $18 million in funded grants and contracts, a lot of that's going to base operations at the university. And so that's actually supporting and making our university more sustainable long-term, too. Out of that $18 million, you know, maybe about $4 million of that is funding base operations at the university. So we have lights, and we have power, and we have... And that's just an important thing I'd like to point out. The amount of money that we're getting from the state versus what we are funding the university is disproportionate. We're bringing in about $14 for $12 on my slide here for every $1 that we receive in state funding. Mm-hmm. And it's across a very, very wide range of different funding sources. So,
question?
Yeah.
What kinds of DOD projects is ASAP involved in?
We have been working with DOD quite a lot on looking at fuel supply issues and looking in particular at the option for potentially having a coal to liquids or gas to liquid supply in the state. That's something that we've looked at. We've looked at some of the language in the defense bill related to Section 526, which doesn't allow replacement of the fossil fuels that they're currently using with something that has a higher greenhouse gas footprint, and how that impacts what they can and can't use in the state of Alaska in terms of fuel supply. So those are the kinds of things that we've looked at for them. Here's a map of some of the projects that we've been working on and where they're located. You can see that we're very much a statewide organization. We have projects all over the state. We've worked in a lot of different technology areas. The way these have been funded, it's been very different mechanisms. For example, the small modular nuclear reactor project is something that was a direct request of this legislative body. Wanted to look at what the opportunities might be in Alaska, and we completed, a pretty comprehensive study of that. It's certainly something that I think is of interest as a possible option in the future, but it's not something that is available today, so it's not something that we're going to be making any decisions on. Go ahead.
Good. Way to lead this slide off. Small modular nuclear reactors.
Sorry.
So that's great.
Yeah.
Thorium. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, I am.
Is there any merit in that, or is it just the Chinese spending $400 million and got 392 PhDs working on a pig in a poke?
No, it's valid. I mean, there's different kinds of nuclear material that you could use for producing heat, which then you're going to use to generate power. Plutonium, thorium. You know, there's several different alternatives to uranium. I am not an expert in particular on what the Chinese are doing, but I have heard other credible entities say that thorium would be an alternative to uranium as a fuel source.
Thank you.
But, Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Gwen, there are other places now in Canada looking at this, probably more significantly. So is it ramping up in discussion, or is it just laying as a fallow discussion?
Yeah, it's interesting because in Canada, there's been a lot of discussion about potentially using small modular reactors just as a process heat source. Mm-hmm. So, for example, with the oil sands and things like that, using heat to extract heavy oils, basically. I would say that the issue that we have in this country is that the process for licensing a small modular reactor is through the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And ironically, Alaska's had a huge impact in moving the discussion forward at the national level because of the project that was proposed in Galena a decade ago. That actually really pushed the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to develop a process for a small modular reactor. But the way it works is that the industry participant pays the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for running through the process, and it's a many, many tens of million of dollar process. And once you put a docket in front of them, the clock starts. And so right now, there's nothing that's in front of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for permitting.
Okay.
And so it's not something that's going to be available on a short-term horizon in this country.
And we asked about it. We were in D.C. talking to the regulatory agency, and they say just getting experts that can handle the information coming their way is very hard to get, and it would be project specific. So the industry would actually have to pay for the experts to go on staff is what I heard.
That's exactly right.
So there's a real barrier there until somebody puts the money down, the experts don't even show up.
No, that's absolutely right. A few other things that I think are potentially of interest in here. Senator Coghill, you've been interested in biomass. I know you were instrumental in working with the Delta School on getting that system up and running. That's an area that we're really starting to develop this team approach again. We have researchers not just in the School of Natural Resources that are looking at long-term production of biomass, but also looking the engineers working on conversion technologies. And now we're bringing in also atmospheric science experts and pollution experts that are looking at how can we maybe bring together a few different things, like looking at the particulate issue with some of these other questions. And in our case, we're even going a step further now and saying, hey, we've been working on energy storage and alternatives for grid management, and are there ways that we can be working with Golden Valley, and this is a conversation we're having, to manage their generation sources, specifically the Eva Creek Wind Farm, while looking at alternative heating, like ceramic heating, that is controlled at the utility level. And so that's a kind of alternative. What can we be doing to fix some of these issues that we have looking at the broad picture? What are all the opportunities we have? What's the problem? How can it maybe fit together?
For example, Gwen, that question is talking about how to take a 20-megabyte swing over against what you would do on a flywheel in a small town where you'd have a 10 kW swing.
Yes. But it's related. That's right though. Flywheels are something that we have lined up to test on our test bed right now. We have a lot of interest in flywheel testing in Alaska. But the challenge that you bring up with managing loads, it's a problem. It's a bigger problem sometimes in the small communities, but it is not dissimilar here on the rail belt sometimes, whether you've got Fire Island, Eva Creek. There's obviously a request for a BESS system in the Anchorage area as well. These are issues that are a little unique to Alaska, and there's other alternatives. We've worked on energy storage for a decade now. We've tested some advanced energy technologies in our lab. We've worked with a lot of partners in this state. We've also recently attempted to test a battery in the field, an advanced battery technology in Kotzebue. That wasn't successful. It got shipped back before that battery was ever turned on.
Hmm.
It wasn't ready for prime time, and it wasn't designed to operate in an Arctic environment.
So, Gwen, if I might, Mr. Chairman, the BESS system is probably one of the kind of the leading experiments on battery technology. I mean, they took a big battery and used it for power outages. It really wasn't for washing power or stabilizing anything.
That's
other
exactly
than
right.
So have you looked at that in its uses and potential uses? Have you kind of looked over to see if you know, as a consumer and as a co-op member of the Golden Valley, I always want to make sure we get good return on investment, but I haven't heard of any kind of critical oversight of that. Have you been looking at it in that regard?
Well, I mean, the BESS has been very successful in what it was designed to do, is basically to support that northern end of the intertie, but it's only designed for 300 lifetime charge-discharge cycles. It's designed to support a brownout scenario. Mm-hmm. And what you're looking at when you're looking at, like, integrating an unfirm source like wind, which you have no idea what's going to happen in the next 5 minutes with wind energy, on a grid, you either need to have some kind of spinning reserve to support that, or you need to figure out some kind of an intermittent storage or other mechanism for being able to shift, move that power to another source. And one of the things that we're looking at with the utility industry right now is whether storage, which has inherent inefficiencies and a lot of costs associated with it too, is the only mechanism for doing that, or whether we can do things like having ceramic dump loads that are controlled at the utility level. So they're controlling it and can instantly shift a load to heating sources, which are inherently more efficient than a round-trip efficiency in a battery. That's the kind of thing that we've been looking at. But we also look at what battery technologies would be viable in the state.
Gwen, Senator Egan had a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. To follow up on Senator Coghill, Gwen, can you explain flywheel technology?
Oh, yeah. There's actually a flywheel operating in Alaska right now at Yusa Belly Coal Mine. But basically what you have is you're storing energy in a rotating mass. So, and by doing that, and depending on the size of the flywheel and the speed that it's spinning at, depends on the amount and the weight, really, how much inertia there is, that's how much energy you can store. And generally, the flywheels that we're looking at today don't store large amounts of energy, but they can store small amounts of energy pretty efficiently for short periods of time. So when you have like a gust, or, you know, there's a dramatic shift in load, there's big, if you have a transient loads, you can use that to
smooth
things out. So that's one strategy that hasn't been done in Alaska beyond the Yusa Belly Coal Mine, but it is a potential strategy. There's costs associated with it, and it's O&M too. So we're going to be testing a flywheel that was developed by Williams Technology in our lab in about the next 6 months or so. We're just getting geared up to do that test.
What I understand on the flywheel technology, it's not only just the weight and mass, just shipping in a flywheel if you have, you know, a 50-ton.
Some of these units are really small. We've been working with Boeing on flywheels quite significantly. They have they've developed two different flywheels, and we have been they really wanted almost to transfer the program to us. They wanted to, they thought that the University of Alaska Fairbanks would be a great home for their flywheel program. They wanted to continue to work with us. We didn't have the funding to work with them on that, so we declined that. But we said what our niche is the integration issue. But the flywheels that they're working on are small. Some of them are the size of this table. There's a containment system as well. But these new flywheels that have very high-strength materials, that's why Boeing works on it, because they do high-strength, lightweight materials, that they're not particularly large. Yeah.
I just want to comment, if I can, that flywheel technology is 100-year-old technology that we're looking back at.
Yep.
Old compressors used to have very large flywheels before we thought energy was much more dispensable.
That's right. And there, I think there's nothing wrong with looking at old technologies and seeing how it applies in today's world. The geothermal systems that at Chena Hot Springs is a perfect example of that. There's nothing new about the power plant at Chena Hot Springs. It's essentially a refrigeration system running in reverse. It's maybe not 100-year-old technology, but it's pushing that. But we've applied it in a way that couldn't have been done 100 years ago. So.
Good, thank you. Continue, please.
So, you know, at the end of the day, what we're really looking at is economic development. Where are opportunities for our residents and our businesses in the future? And that's really you know, we have some challenges here, but in some ways that also sets us up for a little bit of a comparative advantage, because we've spent some time addressing and dealing with these issues more than other people have. And so that gives us a little bit of a niche. These are areas where I think that we could really become world leaders or are world leaders. And that's example is high contribution renewables. So, so we've already been talking about this today. On these small islanded electric grids that we have, there are times when we have a lot of wind energy. And we have to do something with that because we can't send it to Oklahoma, you know, or they can't send it to us. And so that's an area that we've gotten very good at that no one else in the country is working on to the same degree that we are here in Alaska. And we are today the established worldwide expert in the integration of wind with diesel technologies internationally. So people come here to learn about how we've developed our systems here. Is there still room for improvement? Yes. But this is an area where we already have a little bit of a leg up, and we have the opportunity to really be the world leaders. Now, what does that mean? I think that that means that there's opportunities for some of these fledgling businesses, and there's a lot of them that are working in this area, to potentially be working in other places in the world. I was recently participating in the Norway or the Iceland policy tour, and what was very interesting to me about that is they have a plan where they bring people from developing nations that have high geothermal potential, and they have a lot of geothermal in Iceland, to Iceland for a free education. When we went on a policy tour, I took four students with us, and they each worked on a policy question. And one of the students, I just read his paper, he was a geologist, but he was working on how Iceland has been exporting knowledge. And he made this really interesting observation. I always wondered, why would they pay for free education of foreign students? And what they're doing is they're creating a pipeline for their businesses, and they have a large number of small businesses that work in geothermal development and exploration industry. They're setting up agents in other places in the world. Those people that got a degree in Iceland and worked with industry and worked with the university there are now going to East Africa, and when they're ready to develop their resource, where are they going for expertise? They're going back to Iceland. That's where their connections are. And so now Iceland has a leg up. They're the ones doing the geothermal development in East Africa. Is that because they have all the expertise? They have a lot of it. But we would too, not Alaska, but the United States. But they're partnering with Iceland because their citizens have been trained by the Iceland government, and now there's a direct opportunity for those businesses to be active in another region in the world. And I think that's just it's just a really interesting perspective that I hadn't really recognized, but our student who spent some time on this dove into that a little bit further. Some of these niche... Go ahead.
That's a good point. The Swedes did the same thing in the bridge building business.
Yeah. I think it's an interesting strategy I certainly have never thought of, actually, but it's an interesting strategy. I think I'm just...
Maybe before we leave the wind diesel part, could you explain to us what are some of the technologies that have landed well on connecting wind diesel? Is it the computer boxes? Is it the energy shift? What is the things that we've landed well in?
Yeah. So one thing about Alaska, what we've done is we've built a lot of different systems that have used very, very different strategies. There's a system, for example, in St. Paul right now that was duplicated at Tin City, which is a radar facility, where they are getting to 100% wind operation, no diesel off, without using storage. What they're doing is they're using thermal dump loads. In this case, they're heating water. And the problem is you still need some kind of a rotating mass to maintain voltage, frequency, support, reactive power. And they're using a synchronous condenser to accomplish that. And so that's which they're driving. So that's basically what they're able to do there. There's one strategy. There's other strategies that have been used. There's energy storage. There's battery systems. That was the plan for Kotzebue. They are right now having to ramp back on their wind production because they don't have a battery. And they were intending to go more to this high penetration level of wind with their diesel systems. So there's about 30 developed wind projects in the state right now. Some are underperforming, and I think it's an opportunity we can get better, but the control and distribution, that's another strategy. How do we control it? The lab that we've developed at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and there's a picture of it on the top of that CIP request, It duplicates an entire Alaska electric grid with all of the generation sources. We have the diesel there, but we also have a wind turbine in the lab. And the reason we have it in the lab is because we can program that with data from any community in this state, any community. We put the data in, the generator turns at that rate. It's like we have wind there. And we can recreate any event. So if there's a high, you know, gust event, whatever that is, we have a programmable load bank where we can, that's our village, right? That's the village. And it might turn on loads at odd hours and have motors that create, you know, problems. And so we can recreate that. We can do fault simulation. We can create all these things that happen in the real world, unbalanced phases. And then we can start to tweak how we can improve these kinds of systems. So how can we get offline? And so one inverter system that we tested recently that was supposed to be a grid-forming inverter, so it could form the electric grid without the need for the diesel generator and that the wind generator would serve as that spinning mass. It was installed in Kakanak. It didn't perform properly. We set up the same system on our test bed in the lab. The developer came in, the manufacturer of the equipment came in, they fixed the problem in our lab, they reprogrammed the system, we ran it through all the paces for what might happen in the field, and once the developer felt comfortable with the results, then they went out and did the fix in Kakanak. So that's an example of how we work with industry and the resources we can provide, because, you know, in Kakanak, it's going to be a lot more difficult, and you're not going to be able to have that full range of things that might happen. It may never be windy when they're out there in Kakanak. They might not have wind, and it's difficult to test.
Can I just dovetail right on to what you just said? Now, Gwen has gave an excellent overview of how they provide the technical support and the R&D support, and you solved a problem.
Right.
Okay. And I just wanted, for us at the table, and I know you guys are pretty well versed on it, but maybe people at home that are watching is now Avtec, you know, I got to take my hat off for a minute, you know, and where we integrate the real hands-on training, the nuts and bolts, where we've got the diesel, we've got the wind, and we've got the solar, and we integrate all that in real time in a load bank, just like what you're doing on the R&D, but now we take it down a notch further, and we do that blue-collar training for our rural Alaskans, and we teach them how to maintain and service and manage those systems and send them back to the villages. So it's a win-win, and that's that integration between the university and Avtec.
And today it's happening. My entire wind team is at Avtec today. We are doing a training session today and tomorrow where we have the researchers from the university, we have people from communities all over the state, we're using the facilities that are set up at Avtec, and we're doing cross-training on all that today, literally. So you didn't know that, but...
Well, we work closely. Well, anyway, I'll just be quiet. We got a plan, and the university in Avtec works good.
It's excellent. It's great.
Yeah, I like this slide because it shows the world at night, and it really shows, you know, where there's a large part of the world, you know, that still there's population, but there's not consistent access to an electric grid and power. And especially now, it's pretty ironic because I was recently at a village power conference, which was looking at these international issues. And with the information age and people having more and more cell phones, they're pushing more for electric power because they don't really care about lights at night nearly as much as, I need to charge my cell phone. How am I going to charge this thing, right? And so this is an area, again, as these places become electrified, it's not going to look like the lower 48 grid. It's going to be these small patchwork networks that ultimately will become connected, but they're going to be dealing with a lot of the same kinds of challenges that we have in Alaska. And so we have, like, for example, our renewables integration program. We're working with people from Australia. The Northern Territories has a lot of isolated, what they call non-integrated communities, and 75. And so we had one of their researchers come to our university for 2 months earlier this year to work with us. They do high penetration solar diesel systems, and we wanted to see how that compares to what we're doing here in Alaska. We are now sending one of our top researchers there for 2 months. He's leaving next month. So we are working on a very international level. We have a researcher from Denmark that's been part of our research team for quite a while. So we have an international network that we're working with. not just here in Alaska or in this country. And the national labs are a big partner of ours as well. This is our lab in Fairbanks. I just mentioned that this is essentially the village in a box, right? So this is, but what the things that we're doing here, I really want to emphasize, while we designed this to really look at some of the integration issues in a rural community at full power level, so the same size diesel generator, same size wind system, it's scalable. And so the things that we're testing here are just as applicable potentially to some of the issues that we have with integration on a rail belt as in a village. And so this is the only facility like it in the world. We have pieced together the system with funding from a lot of different sources because we believe that this is what was needed. And working with industry in the state, we have an industry advisory committee. This is what they thought they needed as a tool to really perfect integration of these systems. And so we built it at UAF. We have had a huge amount of interest from industry. We have a lot of projects that are lined up to work in this facility. The problem is that we still have a little bit more work to do to really build this out to the full level that we want to see and the full range of technologies. The flywheels, for example, right now we don't have a containment system for flywheels. So that's a problem for us because the first flywheel we're going to test, I guess they're going to have to pay for the containment system, right? But then we want to have that available for future projects as well. And so a large part of the capital improvement project request is to build out and complete this lab facility so that we can use it across the whole spectrum of technology that we want to be looking at in Fairbanks. So,
Gwen, for my ignorance, could you expound on containment for the flywheel? I got my idea of containment, and then I want to...
Sure. When you have a lot of energy like that, and these things are spinning at the RPMs on these things, I mean, we're talking tens of thousands of RPMs for these advanced flywheels. And so there's a lot of energy, but there's a lot of potential if it fails, if there's a bearing failure or something like that, they can explode and dramatically. And so there's got to be some kind of a secondary containment system just for protection. And that isn't necessarily a huge cost, but it's a real cost. And that needs to be developed. It's not research.
That's what I thought. I just wanted to make sure it was when you had a come apart and not an energy storage issue on containment of power. Yeah. Okay.
Nope. We have several batteries that we've been testing here. One example is a flow battery. It's a product by Prudent Energy. We've worked with that manufacturer through several generations of that particular product to try to improve it, identify failure mechanisms, and then try to get it out into the field. And the last version we had, it worked really well. And the problem with that particular battery is that the cost is high. So they've been trying to decrease the cost by reducing the cost of individual components. And you start to see failures in things like valves or pumps and things like that. But the cost was too high. When they did an economic analysis, and this one was supposed to go out into the field, it was going to cost $26 a kilowatt hour between the capital and the operating costs. And you know, we just said that's not viable right now for the state. So we're still looking at that, but we're also looking at the economics. It's not just about technical success, but it's, are these really viable in today's environment? I should mention another example is waste heat recovery, a success story that we just completed testing on a waste heat recovery device. It's similar to the Chena Hot Springs power plant. Same concept, we're using low quality heat. You're generating additional power with that. In this case, we're looking at low quality heat from rejected heat from a diesel generator, using that to generate power. And we completed a 1,000-hour test on that particular unit through, again, a range of different scenarios. It worked really well. It's on its way out to Tok. To deploy at the power plant there for secondary testing. So we're working with AP&T on that. Here's the hydrokinetics. We've talked about this already. Debris is a big challenge for this particular industry. And the debris diversion device is actually a picture of it. There in the low, it's up against the bank. There, it's not in operation. But it has a rotating cylinder that kind of it's actually with bridge piers, they do this sometimes to deal with debris too, where it rotates freely because it's got fins that allow it to do so, and then it can rotate off debris. And we also have part of the system is a buoy that we've designed that's really designed in such a way to shed debris too. And so between the two of them, they worked really effectively last summer in Nanana. This particular picture is from Eagle. This is at Alaska Power and Telephone. It was a 25 kW unit. So when it was operating, it met about half of the community's generation needs.
Gwen, if this works in Nenana,
it'll work
I'm
anywhere.
Sure that there's going to be some local fishermen that Senator Coghill and I both know that's going to take a little literary license on keeping that out of their fish wheels, because drift's a big problem with fish wheels.
Yeah. Actually, we have some awesome, we've been working with, you know, people there, and it's, yeah, it's, we have some great video footage of fish wheels being taken out by debris. It's pretty impressive.
Senator Bucicki.
Are you doing any subsurface work that isn't as seasonal? And do you think permitting departments will begin working with us a little better for possibly permitting subsurface hydro projects in rivers and tidal
floods? We have a really close relationship with some of the permitting agencies, and that is one of the things that they really are appreciating, is that the kind of comprehensive analysis that we're doing is the sort of information that they need to streamline the permitting process. For example, fish, you know, we're not really worried about the adult fish as much as we're worried about the out-migrating smolt that are in the fastest-moving part of the river. And so no one's really ever done surveys in the middle of a river channel, and for those of you that are, I mean, that's not so trivial. We've actually had to develop a way to capture fish in the middle of the river channel that has never been done either, because no one's ever done that. And so that's the kind of stuff our engineers are working with our fish biologists, and we're recognizing whether these are waves, is it a consistent migration, you know, how do we deal with that? And that's the kind of information that permitting agencies really need, in this case for fish and game. They are very, very happy with the work that we're doing and in this kind of area. But that's what we're doing, is what are the permitting challenges for the industry? What kind of information can we produce that can make that easier for them?
So the subsurface question on not having seasonal generation?
Subsurface question, there's two problems there. First of all, under the ice, the river isn't flowing very fast. There's very little. It's groundwater fed in the winter, and the flow rates are maybe 10% of what you have in the summer. Mm-hmm. There's not enough velocity in the winter. We've looked at that.
So I said in river and tidal. The tide doesn't.
Now, tidal is the same technology, right? What we've been doing is we've been characterizing subsurface debris right now. We've bought a sonar system that we've been using to try to figure out what the challenges are. And in this case, we've been mostly dealing with the in-river environment, but we're working pretty closely with some of the developers that are interested in the tidal energy projects as well. How can we characterize subsurface debris? That's our first focus. The next focus is going to be how do we deal with subsurface debris. And again, this is both tidal and in-river driven state. They need to be protected. And this funding request is actually the next step to work with industry on the subsurface debris question. That's where we're trying to go with it.
Excuse me one second. Let the record reflect that we've been joined by Senator Huggins. Continue, please.
Okay. I mentioned low-temperature geothermal as a niche area. This is a place where, again, Alaska is viewed as somewhat of the leader. I have no idea what happened to my one picture there. But what we've done in Alaska is the very first low-temperature geothermal system in the entire world was installed not at Chena Hot Springs, but at Manly Hot Springs. And that's something that people don't necessarily recognize. But that was back in 1981. It is the first one in the entire world. These systems have been built and deployed all over the planet today. Now, Chena is the lowest operating system in the world, but these are built and deployed successfully, operating all over the world today. But this technology was pioneered here in Alaska, and we never, as a state, really capitalized on that, I think. And I think that there's opportunities for some of these niche technologies where we have a competitive advantage. How can we be enabling our businesses here to be taking advantage of that and leveraging that for opportunities here in the state, but then elsewhere as well? And so in this particular case, we've been kind of continuing with this process. The Chena Geothermal Plant is a good example of an application of that technology. We've now been looking at smaller units to look at industrial waste heat. How can we be generating power, whether that's off a wellhead? Because, you know, the oil industry in a lot of ways is actually our largest producer of geothermal energy on the planet, because there's a lot of heat that's coming out of the ground along with the oil. And or waste heat from a diesel generator? Where are opportunities for making more use of the fuel that we're already using? That's one example of some of the work we're doing on the efficiency side. So.
Senator Richicki?
We have some time, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm used to, you know, a typical efficiency on combined cycle might be as much as 40%, but internal combustion, waste heat on a smaller unit, are you seeing mature efficiencies there as well?
What we're really trying to do, it's very small improvements. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking a few percentage points, right? These are tiny improvements, but if these particular devices don't cost very much, mm-hmm. you know, so if you can purchase one of these for and install it maybe for $50,000, you actually can recover that cost over a relatively short time horizon, maybe 3 years or something like that. So these are the kinds of things that we should be doing and don't even necessarily need grant support because the payback is so short if they work and if they're robust enough and if there's not O&M challenges. And that's why we're working with AP&T, which is a very established utility that can be a partner with us in testing that device. So we're talking about small improvements. Another thing we're looking at right now is fuel additives. This isn't something that the Alaska Energy Authority has asked us to look at. There's a lot of people that believe that there are things that you can do to improve efficiency of the combustion cycle through some kind of an additive, through some kind of a retrofit. And so we're taking a little bit of a holistic look at all the things that have been marketed in Alaska to look at if there are areas where we can see potentially real improvements versus it's not real. And being able to get some credible information out there so that utilities and industry can make some good decisions about whether it would be worth investing in some of these.
Okay.
Difficult to extract fossil fuels. You know, this is something we have a lot of fossil resources, and some of those are ones that haven't been a big focus of the conversation right now. But there's opportunities, I think, looking further out. Heavy oil is obviously a big one, but one of the studies I alluded to earlier is coal to liquids and gas to liquids. You know, there's been several proposed locations for that kind of a operation in Alaska. How can we take advantage of the coal resources that we have, which is one of the largest fossil energy reserves in the entire world? Maybe not today, but that might be something that might be an opportunity at some point in the future for Alaska. Same thing with underground coal gasification. I mean, that's something that it's worth keeping an eye on, these kinds of technologies, and understanding how Alaska might fit in terms of exporting some of these resources that we have in the future as well. So. Arctic shipping, this is something, again, just looking at the bigger picture. You know, last year, 46 ships took the Northern Sea route. Huge increase over the last few years. Those are supported by Russian ice tankers. Not much that we're doing about this right now or that we can do about it. But even if you just look at, you know, an additional 50 ships a year every year for the next decade, we're talking 500 ships. A lot of the new mineral resources are projected to be found in the Arctic, and we already know that Alaska has a huge number of those. Now, how can we take advantage of these different things to address our domestic, our in-state energy needs, but at the same time looking at how we fit into the world economy on a bigger picture today, but then also in the future? We've already talked a little bit about this, but Alaska's been a leader in energy technologies. These are just some examples. Core drilling technique, which is a standard exploration technique for the oil and gas industry. Coil drilling, that was developed in Alaska. Thermosiphons for the pipelines, this is something that was developed, and UAF had a big role in that. The BESS system, that's the largest battery in the world by some measures. Low temperature geothermal. And then this high contribution renewables. These are the kinds of things where we've already been established as a leader. How do we capitalize on that to create economic opportunity and jobs for our residents? So.
Gwen, one question. Do you interface any with the oil industry in Alaska looking at their energy cost, operating cost, or?
Not particularly much. We do. We've partnered with the oil and gas industry on a number of different small, mm-hmm. kind of isolated initiatives. Anything from looking at thermosiphon use up with ExxonMobil, We've worked with BP a little bit. Shell is actually funding a remote data acquisition unit that we've developed to develop a prototype unit for field deployment. That's what we're working with them on right now, but we haven't looked at them on a larger level, I would say.
Alyeska Pipeline, do anything with them?
Alyeska is a good example. We have worked with them on two issues. One is revegetation of the pipeline and how that correlates to some of our biomass programs, because they've had to do revegetation of some of the corridors. And then secondly, we've actually looked at whether there might be opportunity for tapping geothermal to add heat to the pipeline as a way to increase throughput. That's another thing that we looked at. As an example. Again, smaller questions, but part of the bigger challenge.
Senator Cogdell.
And, I really appreciate the work you've done in the drive that you've given to answer the assessing technology options as well as assessing the technology in place. We have had wind now being installed in different locations in Alaska now for the last probably decade in a pretty good portion. What have we found out about operating in colder temperatures, in the swing of temperatures? What have manufacturers said? Are you involved in that discussion?
Yeah, that's a really great question, that is not an unsolvable issue by any means. There's a lot of turbines out there that are operating in the Arctic that are designed to operate in the Arctic, have Arctic weatherization packages, and are doing very well. There's some technologies that have been deployed in the state that have had fairly substantial failures, and it's because one of the problems is that once the air is colder, it's denser too. It's heavier. The air is heavier, and that creates problems with some of these turbines. One particular brand has problems with tip brakes. They count on these tip brakes, and if they get stripped out, the turbine is in a runaway mode, and they can have some really dramatic failures, and that's happened in a lot of places. One thing that this capital improvement project request supports is the development of an Arctic turbine test site near Fairbanks. It's not a large amount of money. It's in partnership with the Alaska Energy Authority, so that we're not deploying technologies out in the field that haven't been tested in the kinds of harsh environment, and that would be up in the Murphy Dome area. We're working with Golden Valley, looking at the site that they had out there. So that's the kind of thing we want to make sure we're not having failures out in the field, and we've had some. But there are also very good technologies out there that have survived fine.
So are we watching those that have already been installed and taking data, or is that all proprietary?
I think that's something that we could really improve. My personal opinion on this, and I could talk about this for a long time, but I believe that if we're funding projects with public dollars, that data should be publicly available, and we should understand exactly how those systems work so we can make future decisions about what kinds of projects we might want to fund. And I would like to see a more holistic approach to data collection of funded projects, really understanding how they operate, where we might be able to improve them, and what we want to invest in the future.
So have we created barriers, or is that just a work that has to be done yet?
It's work that needs to be done. There's a tendency, once you build a project, okay, we built that, we're done, right? And I think going back and identifying how well that worked and was that investment worthwhile, not just what we projected it to be, is a really important step, and it's something we have been talking with the Alaska Energy Authority about. There has not been any identified funding for us to do that. The Emerging Energy Technology Grant Fund program is a little different. We pioneered that program with the Denali Commission, and we set in place as a contractual step a data management plan. So every single contract has a data management plan. This is the data that you're going to provide, this is when you're going to provide it, and this is how you're going to provide it, and it's part of the contract. And so that's worked really well because we have the data, we have the information, and especially with pilot projects, we especially need that information. So I think there's a lot more work we could do, and it's been a huge priority for our program to get better information.
Thank you.
So, yeah.
Any questions?
One more. Transmission is one of the big costs for Alaska, and certainly a lot of it's just hardware, just getting hardware. So on system upgrades, are we working on ways to make sure the electrons flow better? Is there anything in our studies that help us think that through, or is it just we have limitations, we're just going to live with them?
Yeah. One of the challenges for our program is because we don't have very much base funding, we're totally reliant on external grants and contracts. We can't really put a lot of work into a problem unless we have some kind of an identified funding source. That's actually something that the CIP request would help give us some breathing room on. So in the area of transmission, we've worked quite a bit on HVDC. The Denali Commission funded a project to look at smaller converters, HVDC converters, and we've been very closely involved in that project for quite a bit of time. It was Alaska Village Electric Cooperative and Polar Consult in Anchorage that were the leads on that. And we were really looking at the technology. We've just created a fairly comprehensive assessment of that transmission technology, not just in Alaska, but worldwide, what's being done and how that applies here. So that's been our major role there. But we have been doing these kinds of comparative analyses. One is for the Fairbanks market. We just completed a comparative analysis of all the energy options for heat and power for the Fairbanks market to look at how all these different options line up if you look at the same start date, the same projected escalating prices, you know, all the same kind of things. How do they compare? And the truck natural gas option came out very positive in that analysis. So, you know, those are the kinds of things that we're doing.
Thank you.
That brings me to a question. In a state that's starved for energy, we have a tendency to jump at things that don't pencil out. And it'd be interesting I'd like to understand your process of evaluation for some of these projects. We have folks jump on board for some of these things, whether they're wind in places where the product is questionable in quality and cost, and we're seeing the same with some of these natural gas projects. It'd be interesting to see your evaluation tool. And I'm happy to chat about that offline. But what's key is that we evaluate these projects responsibly and deliver the best option for Alaskans, because it's a challenge. Like you said, we don't want to look back 30 years from now and say, not only did we talk about it 60 years ago, but we talked about it in that in-state committee 30 years ago. We need a plan, but that plan needs to have a clear set of expectations and some criteria that helps Alaskans understand what's feasible and what isn't. And that's another area of weakness for the state.
I couldn't agree with what you're saying now. I think there's a tendency to just want to act, want to build, want to do something. And I understand that. I want to be building stuff too. But I think taking this, you know, step and really looking at the whole suite of options in a systematic way, and that's where the university, I think, has a role, because we don't have a dog in the fight.
Sure.
Other than that, we're Alaskans, and we care about what's going to be happening for our state. Yep. So thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Senator Wilkowski, any questions? You good? Egan, Senator Egan? We're all good. All right. Well, Gwen, we appreciate your breadth and depth of knowledge of your business. I compliment you on a very good presentation, and I fully support what you do at the university and your staff. Our next meeting is Tuesday, February 19th, 7:30 a.m.
Don't need to pick you up.
AEA Alaska Energy Authority will be getting an overview of the Susitna-Watonna Hydro Project. Without objection, I'd like to bring the State Energy Committee to a close.